Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 16, 2013, during a live telephone conference call. Welcome to our special Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing the pros and cons of an internet sales tax. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and, as always, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome two experts to our teleform conference call. Each is going to give brief opening remarks, and then we'll take questions from the audience. As always, their more complete bios were circulated to you and are available to you on the Federalist Society's website, so I'm going to be very brief in my introductions. Joseph Henchman is Vice President of Legal and State Projects at the Tax Foundation, where, as an attorney and a policy analyst, he supervises the Tax Foundation's state policy and legal programs, and he analyzes state tax trends, constitutional issues, and tax law developments. Paul Meisner is Amazon.com's Vice President for Global Public Policy and has served in the position for 13 years. Mr. Meisner is both an engineer and a lawyer, and at Amazon, he's responsible for formulating and representing the company's public policy positions worldwide. And with that, Joseph Henchman, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me today. It's a pleasure to be here, certainly alongside Paul, who I've testified with and been on panels with before on this issue, which as simple as it sounds, is a very complex one, and one that the issue dates back quite a ways. And in fact, there's a longer presentation I give on this, which I entitle "The History of Internet Sales Taxes from 1789 to the Present Day," just because there's so much history associated with taxation and to what extent state powers extend geographically. So. Historically, you have the notion that we define things geographically, that state services are provided to people within a geographic line, and consequently tax burdens are imposed to people within that geographic line. And indeed, for about a century and a half after the founding, until about the beginning of the middle of the 20th century, states did not have the power to impose taxes on any items in interstate commerce. Whether that be, even if it was a company producing things within the state and then sending them to interstate commerce, state taxation did not extend to it. And a lot of that came from just the taste during the Articles of Confederation period, when you had states imposing taxes and trade barriers and tariffs against each other, which was doing a lot of harm to the national economy. And that's one of the reasons why we had a constitutional convention that adopted the Commerce Clause and the Tonnage Clause and other provisions that gave federal government authority to limit state power to impose obstacles and burdens on interstate commerce. That began to break down in the middle of the 20th century out of the reality that you had businesses with employees in a state and property in a state, and they were using state services, but were for all intents and purposes exempt from state taxation. And so the Supreme Court, in a series of decisions, the Complete Auto decision is a key one, but also subsequent ones include the National Bellis Hess decision and the Quill decision, which of course is a key one associated with this issue. They began to give states authority to collect taxes on people engaged in interstate commerce. And they set out a couple of standards, and the key one for today's conversation is the idea of substantial nexus. And that is, a state may impose taxes or require the collection of taxes by an entity if it has a substantial presence in the state. And in a series of further decisions, at least in the context of sales taxes, and debatably for the context of income taxes and corporate income taxes, but at least for sales taxes, substantial nexus is defined to mean physical presence. That is, you have property in a state, you have employees in a state. It's something more than the minimum context due process standard, and it's something more than having sales in a state or advertising in a state. Instead, you need physical presence of some kind. Now, states, of course, have not been happy with the Bellis Hess and Quill decisions where this standard was laid out. they're not very happy with any limitations on their taxing authority. And so first against catalogs and mailers, and now against internet commerce, they're working very hard to get authority to collect that revenue. And that authority can come either from a reversal by the U.S. Supreme Court or by congressional action, because, of course, with the Dormant Commerce Clause, that's one of the unique parts of the Constitution that Congress can actually overrule the Supreme Court merely by passing a statute, which is pretty much indisputable. So that's what states have been trying to do for a while and haven't had much success with it. Now, when the Supreme Court ruled in Quill that physical presence was required, they laid out two primary reasons. One, they said the sales tax environment is very complex. There's thousands of different jurisdictions. They all have different rules. It's just a very tough environment to then foist that on interstate commerce. It would be a burden on interstate commerce, they ruled, to impose all of those collection obligations on everybody, every retailer in the country, essentially. And the second reason was stare decisis. This is kind of the way it always was, and the court was reluctant to change things without maybe letting Congress do it rather than the courts. And so that's pretty much where things have stood Supreme Court-wise. The Supreme Court has had many opportunities to hear a nexus case since then, not just on sales tax but on some other issues, but they've stayed out of it. They've stayed silent. And there's a lot of interpretations of what Supreme Court silence means, of course, but that's where things have stood. So a lot of the action has been at the state level and increasingly now at the federal level. At the state level, you've seen a lot of states pass laws attempting to expand their tax authority. Many of these laws, I think, in my opinion, and perhaps also in Paul's opinion, are unconstitutional. They're not accepting the physical presence definition laid out by the Supreme Court. On a lot of them, they're even nicknamed Amazon taxes because that's the primary target that these laws are going after. And what they purport to do is say, well, Amazon is engaged with in contracts with affiliates within the state. These are commission-based, performance-based. For every click you send, you get a commission, and that these are in essence having employees in a state, even though they're not employees in the state. And so there have been a couple of these passed at the state level, a lot more proposed at the state level, and quite a few challenges. New York's highest court recently upheld their statute, whereas a lot of the others in other states have been struck down as unconstitutional. So that's what's happening at the state level. But as I said, a lot of the attention more recently has been turning to the federal level, once again Congress being able to enact a law overruling the Supreme Court's definition of nexus in the Quill case. And the essential quid pro quo that's kind of forming right now is that states will get the authority to collect, to force out-of-state retailers to collect use tax or sales tax from customers, even if they don't have physical presence in the state, even if the company doesn't have physical presence in the state, in return for which the state will have to abide by certain levels of simplifications to their system to make it easier. And right now there's a little bit of debate about exactly what simplifications will be included in the bills. Right now the leading bill on this is the Marketplace Fairness Act. I'm kind of on the record of saying that I think that this is a good approach, but more simplifications are needed to make it meaningful. We can get into that, into the questions, and you get kind of into the esoteric level of how simple is simple enough for Commerce Clause purposes. And in return for those simplifications, states will get to expand their tax authority in this one way. To begin collecting sales tax from out-of-state retailers who are selling into their jurisdiction. One possible rationale for this, at least one that comes to my mind, is ultimately the sales tax is not a tax on the company, it's a tax on the customer. So the customers are physically present in the state. It's just a question of how they're going to pay this tax, whether they're going to pay it right now through voluntary payment or through tax forms, which nobody does, or through the much more streamlined method of having the retailer collect it. It's, you know, you, perhaps somebody out there may dispute whether the use tax is even a good tax, and it's something, it's, at least it's a reaction I get from a lot of people when I explain that, no, if you travel to Delaware and you buy shoes and then you bring them back to Virginia, you actually owe tax to Virginia, even though Virginia has nothing to do with that transaction. It does strike people as odd. However, it's something that the Supreme Court let the states do back in the 1930s, and I've learned to that I have to live with it. I think the big question now is where it's going in Congress. The other element to simplification that is very contentious is exactly what level of retailer will have to comply with the act. There's a de minimis threshold in the bill. The last time around, it was about $500,000. So if until you have $500,000 in sales, you don't have to collect in all of the different states. Some people want and I think the bill now is about $1 million or so. Some people want a dramatically higher threshold. Others want a dramatically lower threshold. My personal opinion is the threshold should be zero, that everybody should comply with this. But that's also a good reason to have a simplified system to make sure that everybody will be able to comply with it. So that's kind of how I see the framework as it is right now. There's little odds and ends out there. There's the Streamlined Sales Tax Project, which was a collection of states seeking to create uniform definitions and voluntarily simplify their systems through kind of like a cartel or a compact type arrangement. That hasn't succeeded. It has about 20 members, all of which are for the most part the small states. There's generally states like keeping their sales taxes complicated. They like providing benefits to certain sellers. They like having different rates for bottled water and soda and candy and food and takeout food. They like throwing stuff like that in there. And until there's some reason for them to change, they're going to keep doing that. And indeed, the number of jurisdictions we have in the United States collecting sales taxes nearing the 10,000 level, almost double what it was at the time of the Quill decision. So, in fact, we're moving away from simplification, not towards it. So these are things that a congressional law might potentially improve. As I said, right now there's a lot of discussion going on about what should be in the congressional bill. And just to wrap up to note just this kind of the facts of what's going on lately, the Senate, in their series of votes that they had, test votes they had for the budget a couple of weeks ago, one of the kind of hundreds of votes that they all did in their Votorama was on some a placeholder for the Marketplace Fairness Act, and it passed overwhelmingly in the Senate, 3-1 essentially, which suggests strong support, at least in that body, for the act or something along like it. And with that, I will turn things over to Paul Meisner of Amazon, and then after that we'll be doing questions. Paul?
Thanks very much, Joe. It never is a good thing when a tax is named after your company, as you can appreciate. Thanks also, Dean, and the Federalist Society for having Joe and me talk to you. I think Joe did a really good job of setting it up, and at the risk of making this a continuing history lesson, I want to emphasize a couple of points that he made. And talk us back. He gives a talk that's 1789 to today, I think is that what you said? So I'll take you 3 years earlier, which was the Annapolis Convention. As you may recall, that was specifically called by several states who were having contentious border disputes with respect to navigation. A couple of states had figured it out. Virginia and Maryland had, and New York and New Jersey had, but Pennsylvania was having some difficulty. So there was an idea of bringing some folks together to talk about interstate commerce. And the leaders of that Annapolis Convention, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, were there to try to fix this. They clearly saw the problem that had arisen under the Articles and were trying to address that. Well, the convention failed because of poor attendance. And so what was the result of that? Well, Madison, Hamilton, and others drafted a letter to all the states inviting them to a bigger convention the following year. So the Commerce Clause that came out of the Philadelphia Convention was arguably the whole reason for the convention. It was certainly the focus of it. And despite what we were taught in grade school, the Commerce Clause turns out to have been the half of the most important compromise made at that convention, at least according to Madison. the way the convention dealt with the Commerce Clause was to give power over interstate commerce entirely to Congress. It's not a shared power. It's not shared between the federal government and the states. It's not shared among the branches of the federal government. It is Congress's plenary authority to decide matters of interstate commerce. Well, fast forward 200 years from 1787 to 1987, and you have a state that is facing an out-of-state business that is selling to consumers in the state and doing quite well, and the state wants the tax revenue from consumers and is actually now asking the out-of-state seller, a company called the Quill Corporation, to collect the tax that is owed by the consumers in the state. And they declined this honor and took the state to court, and it wound its way up through the state system, and the North Dakota Supreme Court decided in favor of the state that Quill, in fact, was required to collect, very similar to what New York's top court just decided, as Joe mentioned. The Supreme Court overturned the North Dakota court on the basis of this unconstitutional burden that it saw as a factual matter. Now, what it has done there, of course, is to be quite activist. It's inserted itself in the shoes of Congress, saying Congress hasn't given the country direction, and we are going to step in and do what we think Congress would have done and evaluate what we believe the burden to be or not. Fortunately, the court recognized the shaky ground of the Dormant Commerce Clause jurisprudence and invited Congress to act soon to address the same issue, but they were acting in lieu of Congress. Of course, this particular branch of jurisprudence is controversial. Justice Scalia, in particular, has pointed out how it essentially erases part of the 10th Amendment, which would reserve rights to the states that aren't specifically given to the federal government. And this power was not given to the Supreme Court. It was given to Congress alone. And so it's a shaky legal ground, but it nonetheless is the law of the land today, 25 years later. The basis on which the court reached this conclusion that it would be unconstitutional as a burden on interstate commerce was, of course, based on the facts of the Quill situation, which, of course, was 1987, and the Supreme Court decision was 5 years later, 1992, a year before the World Wide Web was invented. The technology at the time obviously was quite different than the technology of today, and so initially what the states did soon after the Quill decision was to try to come together and figure out a way to simplify and harmonize their sales tax codes in a way that they could convince Congress that the Supreme Court got it wrong on the facts. That was needed at the time because there was essentially no time had passed between the decision and the time that the states were attempting this. But of course, many years have passed since that Supreme Court decision, and technology has not remained stagnant. So the burden on interstate commerce, we believe, at Amazon has been removed, largely because there is software and there are service providers who can do this sales tax collection and calculation for sellers of virtually any size. And we believe that there are big service providers such as eBay and others, including Amazon, who are in a position to provide the collection service not only to its their own retail businesses, but also to third parties. And we can talk about the details of that in a minute. I think Joe is right that the federal legislation has a lot of support at this point, certainly in the Senate, but also in the House. And it's based largely on a couple of things. First of all, Joe mentioned how the Streamlined Sales Tax Project arose in the late 90s and operated pretty much as the only game in town until a couple of years ago. And let me explain that. The Streamlined Sales Tax Project really took it upon themselves to develop a harmonized code, which is called the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement, which provided a lot of simplification, not uniformity for sure, but a lot. It attracted about two dozen states to join on. Well, these states tended to be very small ones, and they had a hard time getting other followers. And so by about 2008 or 2009, it became apparent that the big states just simply weren't going to join on, and it wasn't going to work as a national system. there had to be another way. And the Marketplace Fairness Act that is before Congress now is very similar to a bill that was introduced 2 years ago. And the main innovation of that bill was allowing states to come in under two different regimes. Both require simplification. One would be the streamlined sales tax project, and the other would make minimum simplifications as required in the legislation. And in that way, now the large states could come in, and it could be politically feasible. The quid pro quo that Joe mentioned between giving the states authority but requiring some simplification, I believe, is met by either of those approaches, either by becoming a member of the Streamlined Sales Tax Project or meeting the minimum simplifications in the federal legislation. But as a stopgap measure, what Congress has done is to just to make sure that that it wouldn't even with these simplifications there wouldn't be too much burden on interstate sellers. They've decided to carve out some number of sellers online, and this is the de minimis threshold that Joe referred to. It's also known as the small seller exception. The whole idea is that below a certain annual sales threshold, sellers are not going to be required, or the states cannot require out-of-state sellers to collect if they're below that threshold. Joe's right. It's set at $1 million in the current bill, and I think that's where it'll stay. We would like to see it much lower. In fact, we had suggested $150,000, in part because of the surprising demographics of online commerce. I think people forget that the vast majority of sellers online are small. And in fact, at $150,000, that would exempt 99% of online sellers. So only 1% of the sellers who sell on the internet have sales, annual sales of above $150,000. So when we go up to $500,000 as a carve-out or $1 million, it's really even cutting into the 1%. So it's well under 1% of the sellers online would be affected by this collection requirement under the Marketplace Fairness Act. So I think we've answered a lot of the basic fundamental questions in our introductions. I'd like to think we did, but we would be delighted to take your questions in more detail at this point. Thanks very much.
Well, this is Dean Reuter again. Thank you both for those opening remarks. I think we've clarified things quite a bit. Let's do open the floor to questions. If you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and the pound button as soon as you hear the automated announcement, so stand by for that. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And before we go to audience questions, let me give Joseph Henchman a chance to add to his remarks. If you have anything you want to say in response to Paul Meisner's remarks, take a minute or two.
I think maybe the only real difference between us is whether the existing law is adequate enough to completely alleviate the burden. And on that, I'll just note that complying with sales tax, of course, is not just finding the rate, although there are a lot of lookup services for that, although actually having the zip code isn't usually adequate. There's a lot of zip codes that straddle jurisdictions. There's even a zip code that crosses the California-Oregon line, for instance, Oregon with no sales tax, California with a very high sales tax. Actually, probably the bigger issue is a lot of the interpretations about what is taxable and what is not at different rates. My favorite example of this is a circular I got from one state revenue department parsing the question of ice cream cakes, and it goes through six examples of ice cream cakes, determining that three are taxable and three are not taxable. There's a lot of state tax departments out there that have not provided clear enough guidance to be able to foist essentially what they're doing on a universal basis. So I'm very concerned about that. The definitions that the Streamlined Sales Tax Project have come up with would be helpful. It's worth noting, of course, that they're not incorporated in the current federal legislation. So if the law were passed, there's really no incentive to adopt those definitions. But that said, I think the current proposal's miles better than a lot of previous ones.
All right. With that, let's go to our audience for questions. We've got a couple callers with questions at this point. If you want to join the queue, again, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller now.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. It does not seem to me that it would be too difficult to administer this kind of system. But the fact that what's on the proposal on the table now is not as bad as it could be is hardly a reason to adopt this legislation. And let me suggest three good reasons why we should not have an internet sales tax. The first is, as pointed out, this is a tax on consumers, not on businesses. And although I hate to adopt Tea Party rhetoric, consumers are taxed enough already. The second good reason not to adopt such a tax is that it will simply provide another source of revenue to irresponsible state and local governments that are not balancing budgets and are not spending money responsibly now. As, for example, I cite Exhibit A, my state of Illinois. And the third reason not to adopt an internet sales tax is that it will, quite frankly, diminish economic activity and thereby diminish economic growth. It will do that by directly increasing prices paid by consumers in the amount of the tax. And second, it will indirectly increase the prices of the goods and services sold on the internet, because the administrative burden of collecting that tax will, of course, be initially borne by the sellers, which will be passed on the consumers. So I'd like to ask either speaker if, in light of those three objections, you still are as optimistic or as favorable toward the so-called, whatever it is, internet fairness tax that's currently on the table.
Well, I guess I could start. Go ahead.
Yeah, Joe, you can go. I'm fine.
Okay. This is Joe Henchman. All very good points for kind of arguing against taxation generally or excessive taxation, which certainly nobody's in favor of. Another factor to consider, of course, is the question of neutrality, which is states have decided to have a sales tax, at least the vast majority of them, 44 or 45 states. And the question is what should that sales tax apply to? And right now, retailers are spending a lot of money and making a lot of noise pointing out a disparity in that when they sell something over the counter to somebody, they have to collect sales tax. When somebody goes online, in many cases, sales tax is not collected on that item.
But those retailers have the same option to make internet sales, and many of them do.
You're correct, yeah. But it doesn't affect the point that a large percentage of commerce right now is escaping state taxation, and there's no economic justification for that. So you kind of get into a situation where there's people are being treated differently, so do you kind of level up and level down? I'm generally in favor of kind of leveling up, and if somebody's getting a benefit, extend that benefit is the way to extending the benefit rather than extending the burden is the way to solve it. But the only real way to extend the benefit in this case is to abolish state sales taxes, and I don't think that's likely to happen.
This is Paul. Mr. Applegate, you raise a lot of good points, and I'm sympathetic to them as a good conservative. The problem here is that it is a non-compliance issue. It's rather than changing the policy, as Joe suggests, we're actually just having a lot of people not complying with existing law, and the effects can be far-reaching. I've had one-on-one conversations with many conservative governors who are just really afraid of having to raise income tax rates or even adopt an income tax in the first place if they can't count on the sales tax revenue, which is bleeding out. Some people have tried to characterize this as a tax increase. It really isn't, not only because there is the existing law, but if you think about it as an increase, if this legislation were to pass, then you have to ask, well, it's an increase to what? Is it an increase over yesterday, or is it, 5 years ago before so much bleeding through the non-compliance took place? And so, I get the point about, giving another source of revenue to the states, but they will find it in other places. And I think as conservatives, I think we generally would want to have a transactions tax rather than an income tax. But, the governors who don't have those income taxes today are being faced with that real prospect.
Well, I have to say I disagree with everything that's been said, including and the, but I will let you move on to other questions, and thank you for your responses.
If you'd like to join the queue of our questioners today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, it's Ellen Baker in Glacier, Washington. I have some concerns about the structural relationship of this whole concept. I mean, enforcement is everything. And it concerns me a little bit that the federal government should be policing for the state's internal mechanisms. I mean, the collection of sales tax becomes now a federal matter. Or would the federal government be serving the states at this point as an intermediate customer? I mean, right now they have a duty, you know, to provide for the national defense, the post, blah, blah. Now they're partnering with states to collect their sales tax. I'm a little bit concerned about the mechanics, the actual mechanism. We already have the EPA in our county in working, partnering with local environmental agencies, and I'm seeing them team up together. It's creepy, and I'm seeing sales tax collection becoming some sort of this new structural relationship. I just wanted to reflect on that. Are they providing a service to us, the people, or to states? It's odd. It's new. Thanks.
Who wants to respond to that?
This is Paul. I'll go first this time, if that's okay, Joe. Ms. Baker, I can sympathize completely with the concerns about the EPA, and it's never a good thing when you have the EPA compared to an issue you support. But in this circumstance, it wouldn't be the federal government stepping in. It would be the federal government stepping out of the way. They stepped in 1968 and then again in 1992 to disallow the states from enforcing their own rules. And their, you know, the rules vary very much from state to state, and that's, you know, part of the choice of federalism. And so what we're trying to do is get the federal government out of the way at this point and to take them out of the business of judging whether or not the states have the right policies.
Well, I hate to interrupt. Can I, a minor interruption there?
Of course.
When you say states to states, let's say a seller in Minnesota is selling goods to someone in Nebraska. If the federal government is being, I mean, what would people do? The tax man from Minnesota would visit businesses in Nebraska to collect the tax? I mean, how did the federal government get out of the itself?
This is Joe Henchman. That's a great example, because it shows precisely why you need some federal structure if we're going to have states collecting sales tax on interstate commerce. Because in your example, you had somebody in Minnesota, somebody in Nebraska, and that's not even all of it. I mean, the truck's going to go through a couple of other states. Maybe there's a server farm in Texas that's serving it all. All of these states potentially could say, that sale happened on my territory, and I get to apply my full sales tax to the transaction. And unless you have some federal structure defining what state gets to tax it and at how much, that's a potential you're going to have. And, of course, it is a little bit new in the way that you describe it, but I'll only note that preemption, which this is a type of preemption law, goes back quite a ways. And that is setting up some kind of federal structure, not to intrude on the sovereignty of the states, but to allow them to pursue what they're doing in a way that's not harming other states. And I think that's the guiding post that needs to be behind this effort.
Paul Meisner, did you have more on this point before we move to our next caller?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Steve from Maryland. I wanted to comment on why I think that the proposed bill would be very harmful to the economy. It has always been argued that it's not fair to, you know, brick and mortars to be able to have to sell price and charge sales tax, but internet online retailers don't have to charge that sales tax, so that the consumer gets a better price. But the fact is that it's looking at it from only one point of view. From a online reseller, you have a delivery charge that almost everyone has to, you know, give free delivery, or the consumer has to pay free, you know, has to pay for delivery charge. So it's not, you know, cheaper to the to the consumer. And secondly, in many cases, for, again, looking from the online retailer, many products have a 30-day return policy because you can't try on the clothes. You don't know how it's going to fit, whether it's shoes or clothes or at certain types of equipment. You need to try it. So to have the delivery charge by an online retailer and to have the additional cost of a 30-day guarantee, you know, return policy that retailers don't, brick and mortars don't have, increases the cost of the online retailer significantly. And although I have no basis to dispute, I have no reason to dispute, the percentages of retailers which are smaller, you know, online retailers which are smaller that may be exempt, the fact is that once you get into the larger volume, I mean, all large online retailers at one time were small, and you impose, you know, this threshold. It's sort of like, okay, well, we may not want to go sales because then we'll have to have the cost of reporting. And once you reach that level, it will injure and hurt online retailers, and they have contributed tremendously. I mean, a longtime consumer from Amazon thought it was wonderful what it did. Okay, and look how it's helped spurn the whole, you know, that whole business. So I'm very much opposed. I think it will hurt the economy, and states don't do anything to earn the sales tax. And they're not supporting the retailers there. They're not providing services to the retailer there in order for them to collect. So I can understand why a retailer in the state should pay sales tax because the state's providing roads, safety, et cetera. But for someone located outside the state, they provide no services. And I don't think it's fair, and I think it will harm the economy.
This is Joe Henchman. I'd only note that I think he raised a lot of good points and underlying the debate over the whole question. I'd only note that the sales tax, although a retailer remits it, it's actually both the legal and economic incidence is borne on the customer. So it's actually something the customer is paying, and the customer is benefiting from a state's roads and services and whatnot. I think the question would change dramatically if states were talking about imposing taxes directly on companies and individuals who are not in the state, which indeed they're doing in the with respect to corporate income taxes and individual income taxes. And at least we at the Tax Foundation work very hard against those efforts by states to expand their authority, as well as attempts to expand authority beyond in sales tax beyond those permitted by courts and Congress. So I'm very very aware of the danger of giving states too much authority over people that are not present in the jurisdiction. As for the question of the economic impacts, of course, all taxes have are costs to the economy. It's a question of whether they're worth the benefits. And ultimately, I think that's something that the people in every state need to decide, not necessarily the courts or Congress.
Mr. Meisner, did you want to respond here? Or?
Yeah, thanks, Dean. Just very briefly, I agree with what Joe just said. I might also add that there's this notion that somehow online or remote out-of-state sellers will be harmed by collection. And the fact is, we collect, Amazon does, in well over half of the jurisdictions in which we operate globally. We collect a sales tax where it's equivalent, and those jurisdictions are growing just fine. And so it is, as Joe says, a tax to be borne both economically and legally by the buyer who is in the state where the tax is due.
Let me ask you a question here. On the exemption for retailers that are under $150,000, is it the first $150,000, or so that if somebody sells $155,000, do they pay? Are they responsible for collection for the entire $155,000, or just the $5,000 over the first $150,000?
As it's presently written, this is Joe. It's a cliff. So once you if you have sales under that threshold, you don't have to do anything. And
right.
Once you go over that threshold, you have to collect on everything.
Okay, I see.
And it's not 150. I think that was just the number Paul threw out. Right now, it's set at $1 million in the legislation.
Right, right. Yeah, I apologize. That's correct. Right. We have a couple more questions pending. Before we go to those, let me make our typical programming announcement about upcoming calls. For the remainder of the week, we've got 3 calls scheduled. Tomorrow, Wednesday the 17th at 2 p.m., we'll be talking about the Myriad case, which was argued in the Supreme Court this week. That concerns DNA and patents. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. On Thursday at 12 noon, we'll give you an update on the HHS mandate litigation, which is ongoing in several venues across the country. And then on Friday at 12 noon, we'll talk about copyright enforcement. If you have a question for our experts today, Mr. Joe Henchman and Mr. Paul Meisner, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, I'm Tony Conti from Massachusetts. I'd like to follow up on the previous caller's point by noting that the support of this proposal by Amazon and other large online sellers operates as a way to cut down on competition or stop, as the previous caller pointed out, small online sellers from becoming big online sellers. Amazon has figured out how to get around the, or rather to manage the shipping cost disadvantage that online sellers have to bear. But smaller operators with less volume have more difficulty on that score, and having to add sales tax on top of shipping costs is going to certainly be disadvantageous to small shippers. So I see Amazon as, frankly, using the government to protect itself from impending competition.
This is Paul Amazon. I only wish I were that clever. It's not. It's just not true. We have a thriving third-party sales business where many small businesses and individuals sell through our site. We've got over 2 million sellers who sell through our website and use our other services, such as Fulfillment by Amazon. Roughly 40% of the units we sell annually come from third parties. So we're not in the business of trying to hurt small businesses at all. We're actually trying to help them. It's a big part of our business. So that's just not true. And with the million-dollar carve-out, we have, you know, we're talking about well under 1% of sellers who could be required by states to start collecting.
Well, $1 million is not a lot of money in the retail trade.
Joe Henchman, did you want to weigh in here, or?
No, I think that was more directed at Paul.
Okay. We've got one question pending at this point. After that, our lines are open. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, it's Tom Lillis. I'm in Columbus, Ohio. And as a small businessman, I'm petrified that this is going to pass. The idea of $1 million carve-out, I'm old enough to remember when the alternative minimum tax was supposed to catch only millionaires. The worry I have is that as a retailer going cross lines, when I collect taxes for the state of Ohio, I'm an agent for the state of Ohio, essentially. And now what do I do when I have a customer in Hawaii who's challenging the way I'm collecting Hawaiian sales tax? How do I make my presence? Do I have to hire an agent in Hawaii? It strikes me, with all respect to Mr. Meisner, as a good example of Amazon rent-seeking. As he points out, they already collect sales tax in many of these jurisdictions already. And I'm sure that should this bill pass, they will happily sell me a service that will do my collections for me as well, which will, on top of the taxes, will drive down my margins. And finally, I'm not sure what problem this is trying to solve. Don't the states of Ohio and California and Illinois already have the power to subpoena companies and find out which of their citizens aren't paying sales tax and then prosecute them individually?
This is Joe Henchman. Those are some excellent questions. I'll kind of take them in reverse order. The last one being, don't they have subpoena power to be able to collect those records? Certainly states do have that, and they do use it when they have jurisdiction to collect tax, but in this particular instance, states do not have authority to collect collect sales tax from retailers that are not physically present in the state. So it's not so much an enforcement or record-keeping problem with respect to making companies do it. It's they do not have the power under the Supreme Court's reading of the Constitution in the Quill decision to require that.
But the companies don't pay the sales tax, or the consumer should be paying the sales
correct.
Tax.
Correct. All right, so then the question is about the...
I should be reporting the transaction to the state of Ohio.
Okay,
so
then the question is more, why isn't the state going after consumers rather than... why isn't the state going after consumers rather than companies? And states have tried to do this to some extent. And indeed, for large purchases, if you're buying art, if you're buying cars, if you're buying computers across state lines, sometimes the states will find out about you, certainly with art. You just can't get away with it without paying your use tax. And there's been quite a few states that are now putting it, New York started this and other states have been following along, putting it on the income tax form where you have to note whether you have any unpaid use tax. The president just released his tax returns. Illinois got it on there, and it even says on there, do not leave this line blank. So you actually have to write in the zero, and if you're lying, you're committing perjury under the law. But the fact is that with sales tax, it's easier to collect from retailers than it is from millions of individual consumers. And this is the way that we've done it for retailers, essentially from the inception of the sales tax, that we have retailers turned into tax collectors, as you rightly say. They collect it and remit it on behalf of consumers. There's really no other way to do it. I mean, it's not worth it to put a tax auditor or a tax collector on the job to get the $20 or $30 or $40 that an individual consumer owes. It's just not viable. There have been efforts to try to kind of gin up support for use tax payments through publicity campaigns, but those haven't really worked. Going to the broader point that you raise about how you're petrified that this is going to pass in current form, it's a view that I'm hearing a lot when I talk to retailers out there, including online retailers that are essentially, you know, one person selling on the internet and then potentially having to collect in all of the jurisdictions all over the country and potentially even the world, and facing these questions of, well, who audits me? Do they all get to audit me? Whose definitions do I follow? What are the rules? And this is why we need some kind of guidance if states are going to get this authority on this. And I do have to say it's very disheartening that how complex the system is out there. It's something I know. It's something retailers out there know. But that message is not getting through to Congress. And I kind of had a debate during a hearing with Senator Cardin of Maryland, where he held up his iPad and said, "Well, we have these now. Doesn't that make everything simple?" And I had to kind of on the spur of the moment go back with him back and forth. That no, just having computers doesn't mean all of these complexities have melted away. Unfortunately, as I said, because that message is not getting through and because there is a real, one of your questions was, what's the problem this is trying to solve? The problem is that we have a tax system that is treating some transactions one way and other transactions another way, and that's neither fair nor economically justifiable. And so the question is, how do we do that in a way that doesn't harm or destroy the national economy or internet commerce? And I think the bill is a step in the right direction, but it needs more work.
Mr. Meisner, did you want to weigh in here?
Yes, thank you, Dean. This is Paul Meisner. Yes, and Tom, thank you for the suggestion that Amazon is engaging in rent seeking. I'll address that in a second. But to clarify one thing, the million-dollar carve-out is a carve-out for interstate sellers with less than $1 million worth of annual sales interstate. So you could be a $4 million company with $750,000 of it being across state lines, and you would be exempt from a collection requirement. We're not engaging in rent seeking. I know it's kind of a cute point to make, but it's just not true. We do provide this kind of a service to our third-party sellers of sales tax collection. And we do charge for it, but it certainly is not a profitable business. The vast majority of the fee that we charge for it goes to credit card processors. So it's an out-of-pocket expense for us. So a $100 transaction, if there were $10 of tax, we would be collecting that $10, but also having to pay for credit card processing fees on that $10. So we're not going to lose money on it, but we're certainly not making it. In fact, we're not recovering the cost of providing the service. But we're not the only ones either. At present, there are about a dozen different companies who perform this kind of a service. And so the services are out there. So Joe is right that the burdens have not melted away. The federal legislation would remove a lot of them, but the remaining ones are addressed with technology. And that iPad itself isn't the answer, but the complexity that is presented by the current sales tax codes is addressable with software and services, as witnessed by the companies that are already providing it.
Let me make a final call for questions. Our lines are completely open right now. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if there is a final question, let me remind folks to join us for tomorrow's Teleform conference call at 2 p.m. We'll be talking about the Myriad case in the Supreme Court that concerns DNA and patents. Well, gentlemen, I don't see any more questions on our switchboard here. Let me then give each of you an opportunity to wrap up or express any final thoughts you have. And I suppose let's go in the order we opened with. Mr. Henchman, do you want to take a minute or two, and then we'll hear from Paul Meisner?
Sure. We covered quite a bit here today, and this is an issue that I've been working on since I took over the legal program here at the Tax Foundation in 2007. And there is a lot of misinformation and a lot of stuff out there that needs to be addressed. And we've been doing our best to try to explain exactly why we're here and what the issues are. There's a lot of rhetoric out there that at some point somebody passed a exemption for internet sales to help it as an infant industry grow. And that now that the internet has sort of come of age, it's time to repeal it. And that's not true, and I hope that through my opening remarks I kind of emphasize that this is just the outgrowth of how we do taxes in the United States based on geographic jurisdiction. There's a lot of noise. A lot of people don't like the existing system. The states, of course, have never been happy with it. They don't like their ability to collect taxes restrained in any way. And retailers have been very vocal about the disparity between how state sales taxes treats them versus their internet competitors. And so the question is that Congress ultimately is probably going to do something, and I've made the prediction that sometime in the next 3 to 5 years, Congress will be acting on something. And right now what they have in front of them is the Marketplace Fairness Act. There are a few other proposals out there. You can find out more about them and some of the congressional testimonies I've done. Those are on our website at taxfoundation.org. Ultimately, of course, everybody needs to hear from all of you about what the right step forward is. Right now, what Congress has in front of them is the Marketplace Fairness Act, and it has a lot of support. And of course, as I've laid out in my perspective, I think it's a good approach, but it's not yet a perfect bill. Maybe there isn't a perfect bill, but it could use a few improvements to make sure that we're not extending broken sales tax systems worldwide and imposing them and inflicting them really on everybody. With that, it was a pleasure to get the invitation and to share some thoughts, and I thank all of you for joining us.
A final thought from Mr. Paul Meisner.
Yes, thanks, Dean, and thanks again for calling this teleforum. It's very helpful, and it's good to catch up with Joe. I think there is a lot of confusion about what the legislation is and is not. I joined Amazon in early 2000. And at the time, there had been a lot of recent discussion about the Internet Tax Freedom Act moratorium, and that moratorium we fully support. There shouldn't be multiple taxes on e-commerce, there shouldn't be discriminatory taxes on e-commerce, and there shouldn't be access charge taxes. That made a lot of sense, and people were trying to ask if that should be applied to the collection of existing sales taxes, and we never took that view. We took the view quite the opposite, that collection of sales tax is something that it makes a lot of sense so long as the burden is removed, either by simplification or technology or both. And we now are at a point of believing that the burden is no longer there, at least for companies over the de minimis threshold that we've been talking about. It's not a new tax. It's just the enforcement of existing tax. Does it impose burdens on states? No, to the contrary, it's protecting states' rights to choose their own sales tax policies. Can the states take care of this? Nope, only Congress can. Does it violate the ATR pledge? And the answer is a big no. That pledge applies only to income tax, not to sales tax collection, for sure. I think it's important for this group to recognize, however, that this is about getting the federal government out of the way of the states. Had the Supreme Court not been activist in those periods in 68 and 92 and injected itself into this policy discussion, then we wouldn't even have this debate. It would not be an issue at all, because the states would have the right to require sellers who sell into the state to collect sales tax. But it was only because the court jumped in the absence of congressional action that we're addressing this. And so this is not about Congress becoming active. It's about Congress removing the federal government from the question. So I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to everyone today. And Joe and Dean, thank you.
Well, thank you both. On the Federalist Society's behalf, I want to thank both Mr. Joe Henchman and Paul Meisner for joining us today. And to the audience, I want to invite you again to join us for our teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be discussing the Myriad case argued just this week in the Supreme Court on patents and DNA. That is tomorrow at 2 p.m. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.